Now, as it happens, I'm joined now in studio by Shane Ross. Shane, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
And you've written a new book about your time in government, In Bed with the Blue Shirts. I thought one of the most fascinating parts of the book is that you talk about what would be the last days of the last government and the first days of this pandemic. And I guess this is the first, you were the guy there, you were obviously keeping a few notes and stuff, that guy everyone dreads.
Yeah.
And this is the first real insight I think we've got into those chaotic days when you had this government that had been kind of voted out but was dealing with a pandemic. You say democracy took a rest for 4 months there. You also say that the ministers felt that Tony Holohan had usurped their power, basically. Mm. Is that, and like ties into what we're seeing there a bit.
Yeah, I think, first of all, yeah, democracy certainly took a rest. And what I mean by that is, and I think you touched on it there, was that you had in government suddenly a caretaker government in an utterly critical situation, biggest catastrophe probably ever to hit the state. A government which was a Fine Gael government, which is 21% of the vote only, ruling the country. Three ministers, including me, Catherine Sapone, and Regina Doherty-Mee, who hadn't been elected to the Dáil, in a situation where they were taking absolutely momentous decisions, which, you know, billions being spent on rescuing the country. The Dáil really emasculated. The Dáil was sitting in a situation where, there was a limited number of people there. You could only sit for a couple of hours at a time. The place was cleaned, everybody got out, so it wasn't really working. Cabinet meetings were limited to 2 hours. Time you could speak at cabinet was very, very limited. I can remember in one occasion, I think when Joe McHugh was taking the leaving certificate crisis through and cancelling it, we were limited to 2 minutes each. So you're getting what I call that government by guillotine. Everything was rushed. And not only were you getting that, you were getting an absolute mushrooming of what are known as incorporeal meetings of the government as well.
Now, we imagine an incorporeal meeting to be maybe some form of a Zoom where they're all there together on a call and they take a chat. Mm. Just explain to me, we'll go back to Tony Holohan in a minute.
Yeah.
Explain to people how an incorporeal meeting actually works.
Yeah, everybody imagined that, and I imagined that before I found out what happened. You think it's like, you know, the best example of it, I suppose, is the banking crisis, the overnight one, which is very, very famous and went on. But it doesn't work like you think. That's why I thought they'd work that way as well. That people couldn't all be got together at a certain time, so you all get on the Zoom. No, it's a very, very quick meeting, but nobody meets. Which I mean, you get a telephone call, you get a warning saying you're going to get a telephone call from the Department of Taoiseach's, probably the Secretary of the Government, but maybe someone more junior, who's going to say to you, there's this bill or this memo before the government. Do you approve it or do you not approve it? And he makes 15 telephone calls to each cabinet minister. And the norm, you don't challenge any minister. No minister presents anything to you. If you're lucky, you get a look at a paper and the legislation a few hours beforehand, not always. And you say yes or no, and on you go.
And that's literally what you're
saying.
That
is literally what happens. Now, to be fair to them, I did at one stage say to the civil servant who rang me, who wasn't the Secretary of the Government in this case, I said, look, I'm puzzled by quite a bit of this legislation. Could you please find out the following about it? And he did come back to me 45 minutes later and say, this is what it is. But there's no opportunity to challenge the minister. There's no exchange between people. The thing is, it's a real guillotine operation. It's all done about 50 minutes with 15 telephone calls.
Okay, go back to Tony Holohan usurping the power then. So we have the atmosphere here and the circumstances. And then In comes Tony Holohan.
Tony Holohan was a massively powerful figure in government during that period of time. He used to come in maybe once every few weeks, and he'd address a subcommittee of the cabinet, which is what it was, which was ministers. It didn't normally include the Taoiseach, Simon Harris, and maybe one other, and Pascal Donoghue, because he'd been briefing them already. But he'd come in and he'd brief anybody what was happening, and he'd put the fear of God into you, to be quite honest. What he said, but he was very
possibly rightfully so.
Right. Oh, I would agree with taking his advice. I'd be in that camp. But he would put the fear of God into everybody, and of course, people took his advice all along. And what was happening there was gradually over that period, people were getting more and more discontented, including people like Michael Ring, Michael Creed and others like that, and felt that he was getting too much power and he was being listened to too much, that he was closing the country too, you know, too quickly and too great an extreme, and they began to kind of rebel a bit. And we've seen the result of that in the last few weeks. But we have seen, and I see Pat Lee, I read Pat Lee's article there as well, we have seen that politics comes in, and at the end of the day, they made a mistake by not going up to level five a few weeks ago. And then they felt they couldn't resist it anymore, and they took the advice. Because if we got into a situation where we hadn't taken the advice and it got out of control, politicians would be blamed, and rightly so.
Yeah, yeah. As much as the Minister for Health would try and tell us that it's the virus's fault. Yeah,
yeah, we, exactly. Yeah.
No, no, listen, the other interesting thread you make about that period is that you say that this killer virus became a platform for a political resurrection for Fine Gael.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's true. Remember the election, February the 8th. Fine Gael get 21%. They lose a large number of seats, as do Fianna Fáil. It's a disaster for them. And suddenly, during the kind of interim, Leo begins to take prime place. You know, he does all these extraordinary broadcasts from government buildings, but not just from government buildings, from Washington as well, to the people. And people rally to him, very, very much so. And what you see there is a government, a caretaker government, suddenly becoming very, very popular very, very soon after an election which they've given a total and utter thrashing. And then politics comes into it big time, because in the background, you had obviously Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens talking. So you had the Taoiseach actually doing the running and doing all the publicity and getting all the kudos for what he was doing very well at the time. But in the background, them talking. So there was no real opposition, because they were rather offended. They're rather afraid of offending each other, but in case they banjax the talks that were going on in the background. So you had a kind of paralysis in politics at the same time.
And you put a lot of the communication strategy at that time, don't you? Our friend John Concannon being back in prime position, you think he did a really good job of positioning Leo Varadkar. You say people were lapping it up, you say.
Yeah, they were. Well, Leo became a messiah for a few weeks. I mean, we were all desperate. We were all in the unknown, and we needed somebody to give us a bit of encouragement. And he did that very well. I mean, But John Concannon came back at about the same time. I think it was around St. Patrick's Day that he came back as well. And that's when Leo suddenly put himself centre stage, and he was doing these rather dramatic and maybe over dramatic speeches about the state of the nation. But he certainly captured the nation. And then you got these amazing opinion polls, which showed that, you know, he had 75% approval rating.
You see, you know, I think your real problem with this, Shane, though, is there's a line in there where you talk about the Taoiseach was rationing the limelight to keep it mainly for himself, that you and Finney and McGrath were never allowed to give out any news at press conferences. So you were as bad as the rest of them, really,
right,
weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, well, I felt it because what was happening was obviously very few ministers were really in the loop, and there was almost a Politburo sitting, organising.
And this was Leo Varadkar, Simon Harris and Pascal Donoghue, you would say.
Yeah, and Simon Coveney would be kind of part of it sometimes. But don't underestimate, in that situation, also the civil servants. There were some really powerful civil servants who were really taking over to a certain extent. Martin Fraser was the Secretary of the Government, Robert Watt in the department.
Taking over in what sense?
Well, but they would be at these meetings with Holohan and others, and they would be voicing very obvious opinions about dangers and what might happen. What we'll talk about, the dangers to the economy, obviously.
Which is their job.
Yeah, of course. But they were very, very powerful people in that crisis. And the other people, and there were complaints by members of the cabinet that they'd been sidelined, people who weren't at those subcommittees as well. So what really happened was something would come from a proposal would come from a subcommittee, which was civil servant driven, and would then go to the full cabinet, and it would go through very, very quickly.
Now, you were, of course, Minister for Sport, Transport and Tourism. And now, I have to say, there isn't a huge amount about transport or tourism in the book, in lots of ways. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff about sport. I suppose, Shane, how it looked at the time was you had a few kind of hobby horses that weren't all maybe strictly within your remit, and you pursued them with varying success. Yeah. But so let's talk about a few of them now. The 2017 Road Traffic Bill, that got very, very nasty, you say. That was about the drink driving.
Yeah. Well, that's transport. You know, that is transport.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
And that was a bill. Yeah, that was a bill about drink driving. And in fact, it was to ensure that those who were over the limit of 50 always were put off the road. At the time, I discovered, and it was for the first time when I came in, when I was discussing the drugs driving bill with a civil servant, I discovered that, in fact, there was a loophole which allowed people to get off if they were. They got off with actually 3 penalty points. And we were to change that to getting 3 months off the road.
And why did it get so nasty?
I have to say, I was absolutely astounded because I thought it was the most logical thing in the world and the most extraordinarily sensible thing in the world. Drink driving, I thought, was thoroughly disapproved of by now, and that this was something which was out of date. It got nasty because, well, first of all, it was very difficult to get through the cabinet. I mean, I kind of tell the story there, and the cabinet was basically hostile to it. That was the reality of it. They didn't really want to go there because they understood that there would be resistance from the vintners. And the vintners lobbied every TD and every cabinet minister very, very effectively against it. And when I went to the cabinet with this, now I'd done a fair amount of homework about it. I wasn't certain it was going to get through that morning. That's the most unusual thing to do, to go to a cabinet without being certain that it was going to get through. It did get through. But what it did do, it exposed what I didn't realise, the strength of feeling amongst some people, particularly politicians, that rural Ireland was somehow being pushed against and that we had an anti-rural Ireland bias. Now, the funny thing is, the strange thing is, the Behaviour and Attitudes did polls on this, and they found that rural Ireland was absolutely behind the bill, but the spokespeople were not. And they used it as a stick to say, hey, look, this is an anti-rural Ireland minister, anti-rural Ireland government. It's not true.
And in terms of it getting nasty, like, so people were briefing journalists about the fact that you, quotes, had to give up the drink.
Oh, yeah, that came through all the time. I got a lot of stick about that. They said that people were briefing journalists, look, this is only this minister, you know, he's got the zeal of the converted, he had to give up the drink and he's now taking...
Did you have to give up the drink?
Well, I think so, but I wasn't made to. The answer is I gave it up voluntarily.
Yeah.
But I suspect if I hadn't given it up voluntarily, I'd be made to by somebody because I was drinking far, far too much. Yeah. And that
when,
was...
When was that?
Oh, 1980s.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's more than 30 years ago, well over 30 years ago. And I did, certainly.
To the extent that it was affected, we won't spend the next half hour about this, but just to give people an idea, to the extent that it was affecting your life.
Oh, absolutely. It was a menace in my life. And it was, you know, I was drinking far... I don't want to talk. Well, I might. I'll talk about it when the cows come home, but basically it's not really interesting.
Yeah.
I used to drink far, far too much. Morning, noon, night, almost. I was a stockbroker and I was in the Senate. Same time. There was a lot of spare time in both, you know, hanging around. And I drank too much.
So you were able to kind of be a whatever functioning heavy drinker in that media, were you?
Most of the time. I could get by, but I could, you know, I'd wake up too late in the morning and I'd go to bed too late at night because of drink and it would affect my work and my life, etc. And I was winging it a bit. And I told it before, I had a bit of a pound, as it was at the time, with PJ Mara, who was drinking quite a lot at the time, but he wasn't as heavy a drinker as me or anything like that, but we used to knock around together. And one day, and I said, I bet I'll last longer than you. And he lasted 24 hours. I'm still off it. But, I mean, that's not a great virtue of mine. That's just, I did it and I've never had a drink since. And it was a good
compared thing. I presume one of your mockers at times down the years and having a few pints was Eamon Dunphy.
Yeah.
The book, it's kind of at the beginning of the book and I felt it was a very important thing and a thing you're very sad about.
Yeah.
That you fell out with Eamon Dunphy at some point there around when you went into government. Eamon Dunphy, if people don't realise, was your closest, oldest friend, really.
Yeah, that, and I'm still very sad about it. I have to say that. I was the best man at his second wedding and I was, and we got into, you know, scrapes and things together. But he was also a tremendously supportive political friend as well. Eamon was, you know, he was volatile politically, a bit like me, and you couldn't kind of keep up with either of us which way we were going to go on things. But he was always supportive of me, which was wonderful. And he campaigned for the Independent Alliance, which was fantastic. He did great work for some of the other candidates as well. And he supported me in the Senate any time he could. And, I tell the story in the book, and it's sad because we had dinner one night, about as we often did. And then as we often did, and it was a great dinner out in Foxtrot in Bistro One. And we got on very well. And then a few days later, I was listening to the radio and I heard him savaging me on Shauna Rock. Now, I don't mind that. Everybody savaged me in those 4 years. I don't really mind that, but it was kind of very personal. And I kind of was a little bit puzzled and somewhat upset because he'd never done that before in any circumstances at all. And so I just kind of left it. And it just withered, our friendship withered at that stage. I didn't talk to him about it, et cetera, like that. I actually thought he'd probably ring me up and say that's, you know.
Yeah. So I had to do it. And you haven't spoken since, no?
No, we haven't had any contact. So I rang his wife a little while ago when he wasn't well, when I heard he wasn't, because it's a friendship which I'd welcome, you know, back if it were ever to happen. But he's been very hostile ever since on his political programs as well, which he's entitled to do. I rang his wife to see how he was, and I had heard he'd been in hospital and wasn't well, and she was very polite, etc. But I never heard back from him. So that's
was
sad.
There a suggestion that he was expecting you to get him a Senate seat?
Well, we used to joke about that. I mean, I don't think it would be fair to say that.
Yeah, yeah.
No, we used to, we used to, like guys do when they're out for dinner, saying, "Well, if you ever get in, you'll make my wife on the board of RTE. Maybe she was here as a producer, and I want the chair of Ellingus or Senate."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't think that.
Listen,
was...
that's a shame, and none of us are getting any younger. Like, and we need all the friends we can.
You're telling
can
me.
Get. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It is a shame, and you know, he's. But Eamon is. You know, he's. He's volatile and he goes backwards and forwards.
He'll be back, hopefully.
Yeah.
On the Senate seats, when you were doing the deal to go into government with Fine Gael, and you would have been expecting a Senate seat or two, didn't get that. It was all quite toxic around the negotiations, weren't they? You'd call Linda a political corpse and everything, and you didn't get what you wanted in terms of the deal, did you?
No. We got a pretty good deal on policy, right? To be fair, we got a pretty good deal on policy. I mean, Finney McGrath.
Yeah, but the jobs for the boys, you weren't happy.
Yeah, well, that's you put your finger on it, and you put it in language I would prefer you hadn't. But you're right. The policy we got a pretty good deal on. Quite honestly, Finney McGrath and John Halligan and Box Morton got a good deal on policy. What happened was, then the night before, and we'd never discussed the ministries after 10 weeks of bargaining. We'd never discussed them, who got what ministries. Enda said, he kind of sent for me, he said, "Come on up." So I went up to his office and I had, you know, five Independent Alliance people waiting eagerly downstairs, waiting to hear what the news was. And this was to discuss who got what jobs. And I had writing instructions to look for six, right? Mm-hmm. And a few Senate seats. You know, one each. I mean, not quite that, but you know what I mean? About six. They thought six was reasonable because of our political position. And to look for some Senate seats as well, because all minorities in government normally have got Senate seats. And I went into Enda and he said, what are you thinking? What do you think? What do you want? And I told him. And he said, "Well, you're not getting that." He says, "You're getting one junior ministry, one super junior and one senior. Full stop." And I kind of sat back and thought, well, this is the beginning of a long conversation. And by the time I leave here in 45 minutes, he'll give me five or something, et cetera, and a couple of senses. We had an absolute stonewall of a conversation. He didn't move one inch during that period of time. It wasn't very friendly, to be quite honest.
Almost like a corpse.
Well, that had caused him a lot of grief. And I think that was my fault. And I think what I said then had hurt. And it caused him to respond in that way. During negotiations, it was very visible as well. There was a kind of personal hostility. And so I went back and I told the guys and they said, that's not all. We're not going to do it. And I said, OK, that's what I told him. We're not going into government tomorrow.
And then you went home.
Yeah, that's the
to
truth.
To Ruth Buchanan, formerly of this parish. Yeah, go on.
I went home. This is absolutely the truth, which is amazing. We'd all decided, that's it, tomorrow. We might meet and again tomorrow, but it was the deal was off. I told him we weren't going to do it. He knew it wasn't going to be it. There was no government. And the vote was the next day. And that was the last vote was going to be. We thought that would be the end of another general election. And I went home to Ruth and she said to me, "Well, how'd it go?" She's quite detached from politics, really. She doesn't get excited about it at all. And I said, "Well, there'll be no government and that's it. It's all fallen through, etc." And she said, "Why?" And I said, well, look at it. I said, that so-and-so, only giving us three ministries, a super junior, junior super junior, and one other. And she said, and what did you get on policy? And I said, oh, we got everything we want on policy. And she did. She said, her reaction was the same as yours. She says, I just don't believe you. She exploded. She absolutely went into a complete and utter into orbit. She said, you've got everything you want on policy virtually, and you're going to fall on jobs for the boys. She said, tomorrow morning, you're going in there tomorrow morning, and you're telling Enda Kenny you're going into government. Do you understand that? Because you'll be made a laughing stock of if this falls on, you know, on the ministries, because cronyism. And I saw the light, and she was right. And,
yeah.
So I actually rang the others, not Michael Fitzmaurice, but I rang the others. I rang certainly Finian and John on the way in the next morning. And I said, you know, I think, you know, we should think. I didn't tell them that I'd be savaged at home. I said, I think we should think about this again. And they said, yeah, we've been thinking that way too. And maybe we should think about it again. And so the view all turned, except for Michael Fitzmaurice, who stayed out.
Yeah.
Our views turned and we went back and we did accept almost the same day. We met Enda the next day, by the way, the day of it, you know, and he just said, no way, I'm not moving.
And listen, you were given, like, quite a plum job, sport, tourism,
yeah,
and transport.
Yeah.
And also, your minister for state, your junior minister in that portfolio, that would have been regarded as a plum job for any up and coming young man or woman as well. But they weren't really queuing up to be your minister for state, I gather.
Yeah, I tell that story in the book. It's quite funny. Everybody, if they were going to get a junior minister, wants to be junior minister for sport and tourism. Because if they're certain type, not everybody, but there's a lot of travel in tourism. It's very, very interesting. And the sport thing is absolutely fascinating as well. And obviously, if you're interested in sport, you get to all the matches and you see everything. It's a job which is very hard work, but it's also very enjoyable if you enjoy that sort of thing. They didn't totally lose interest in it when they heard that I was the senior minister, but the enthusiasm wasn't as strong there for getting that job.
And how did you get on with your junior minister, who ended up being Patrick O'Donovan?
Not very well. The situation was very, very difficult, and I got several missives from Enda to say, would you please sort out the difficulties that you have? He felt, I think kind of wrongly, but maybe with some justification, that I wasn't giving him enough scope to do various things. And that I wasn't, you know...
That you were hogging the limelight.
Well, I think hogging the limelight is part of it, but also probably taking too much of the kind of the power that was involved in it and doing those things. Hogging the limelight was probably something which he never expressed that to me, but he did feel I think he was left out of decision-making, and I think he was probably right. He probably got too...
Really, yeah. He was going to walk, wasn't he?
Well, so Enda said, told me. Enda got in touch with him and he said, look, if we don't sort this out, he's going to walk because he's not getting enough stuff. But on the other hand, he did do some fairly strange things. He did announce gender quotas in sports NGBs without telling me. He did a few other things, like I had learnt about it on Morning Ireland, and that was something which I had to pull him in on a bit because he should have consulted as well. And so
obviously the relationship had broken down to some extent.
It was bad, and I think that was probably my responsibility because I was a senior minister and maybe should have made a bigger effort. But he wasn't, you know, he was pretty difficult to get on with as well. But we made up for it. We made up. He came to see me about 3 years afterwards, and he said, "Look, life's too short. Let's have lunch. We talk." And we did. We had a very good lunch.
There's a great line in the book where he goes out to Rio for the first week before you do, but he texts you back. But one thing he texts you, you're going to have a great time out here. I thought, all right, that's what it's about. And you certainly didn't have a great time out there.
No.
Tell me about the day you spent just before Mr. Hickey was arrested. He spent a day kind of sounding a bit high on himself, showing you around the place.
Yeah, I mean, Pat Hickey was almost schizophrenic, as far as I was concerned. You know, he treated me.
Yeah, you're not
ways.
Using that in the literal sense.
Oh, not like sense. Sorry, no, not at all. In this sense, he was terribly polite and very, very hospitable at one moment, and then the next moment he was very hostile when you met him in a formal meeting. And this was the day after we'd had a very, very bad formal meeting. Talks have broken down and, you know, it was really difficult. For some reason, the protocol had it that I had to meet him and we had to go around
I go around meeting people in the Olympic Village and the medal ceremonies. And what, and Paddy was very, very polite and he took me around and met people. But the thing that struck me about him was he was terribly impressed by kind of princes. My wife said to me, she says, is there anybody around here who isn't a prince or a princess or a duke or something? And Pat was introducing us all the time. I want you to meet this prince, you know, crown prince of this and that and the other. And then he introduced me to somebody else and he said, this is the Dennis O'Brien of South America, which I was meant to be impressed with.
Okay.
I think I'd just been sacked from the Independent, you know, a few weeks earlier. And this sort of thing. And I thought, you know, he was completely and utterly enamoured with that type of person, and he got to mix with, and you see it in another book as well. He got these, you know, British Prime Minister had impressed him as well. He liked mixing with Putin. You saw this famous photograph of him with Putin as well. That was where he was, and that was what kind of controlled his life. And somebody wrote in a piece, you know, he's grown too big for Ireland, and I think that was one of his problems.
But you did feel a little bit sorry for him when you saw the pictures of him. Was it early the following morning?
It was awful. I mean, the following morning he was arrested and taken away, you know, from his bedroom in his hotel. And you see these pictures of him in a silhouette of him in a wheelchair. And I don't think his health was very good as well. And of course I felt human sympathy for him. I mean, we'd fought like cats and dogs and still have since he came back, in verbally a bit, but I felt very sorry for him because he was lonely. He was out thousands of miles away from home when he was in hospital and he was under arrest. It was a tough place to be.
Now, you are impressed by people yourself as well, particularly sports people. You do like to look, like all politicians, you like to have your picture taken with them, but you do kind of hold up your hands and say you might have gone a bit far sometimes. People will remember Katie Taylor at the airport and you doing Where's Wally popping up in every picture.
Yeah, I've written a whole chapter, which is meant to be entertaining, on gaffes, because I made an awful lot of mostly Twitter-related gaffes. You know, I put things on Twitter which people pounced on, etc. And the primary one, I think, was probably the Katie Taylor one. The Katie Taylor one was absolutely, you know, I was caught red-handed, nakedly, trying to muscle in, I suppose, wrongly, on something that politicians love to be photographed with sports stars when they've been successful. It was a little bit over the top, but I don't blame anybody for it. I'd met virtually all the sports people when they came back to the airport, and I was getting flack the other side for not meeting people. You know, from time to time I couldn't meet people, the successful Irish sports people abroad. And I went out to the Katie, so I went out almost naturally to the Katie Taylor thing to meet her. But what happened there really was, I had a script, and I was very keen to be photographed with her because she just won the world championship. She was a wonderful woman. I'd met her in Rio and she'd had a terrible time there. The problem was I stuck to her for far too long, and that was absolutely true. I hung around to be photographed with her, but also because I was expecting a microphone, an interview with RTE between the two of us, which never happened. But it turned into an absolute farce because wherever she was going, I was going, and she was moving in a very totally spontaneous way, and I moved that way, and the cameras kind of caught me looking to get in the shot, and I was like all politicians,
buying to rights, and you
I was nailed
to the Rob Dave Carney gaffe where you tweeted the wrong name of the wrong Carney brother. People who remember Dominic Perspour, of course, and all of that,
and the fly button, it's in the book that there was the tabloids had absolute. Made hay, not just with the Carney thing, which was Chile wrong Carney, which was a great headline they had, but the fly button one, if I can remember, was even worse, which was wrong. But some of these were wrong, but I won't get to that. But the fly button, I had a photograph which I put on Twitter, which had my tie apparently coming out of my fly button, right? And of course that went viral, right? And it wasn't actually that at all. What it was I tied my jersey around. I tied my jersey around my tie and they went bananas. But it was all of the tabloids, you know, flies and this. They had a great fun with it. So there was but it provided a bit of entertainment. That wasn't...
Yeah, but look, but the other thing is, yes, you provided entertainment, but you were a politician, a government minister. And I think what a lot of people would have felt, Shane, is that you were a great old parish pump merchant. You went out when you were Minister for Transport. Bus Connects was happening. It was quite controversial in a lot of communities. you go out and tell the local residents out there, oh, look, the NTA, nothing to do with me. Bus Connect's nothing to do with me. Don't mind that map you're being shown. And, you know, it's kind of it's irresponsible carry-on.
They were asking me to... That's at a place in Dundrum. And they were asking me to actually do something very specific that evening. And they were saying, hey, we want this route changed here, this route changed there, that route changed the other place. And I said, I can't intervene with individual routes, which is the NTA's job. Now, that came out. What happened there was somebody else who was there came out, who was another politician in his constituency, came out and said how he was saying this and that. That wasn't the case. What I said was,
What about Stepaside Garda Station then, which was, you know, that was one of your major passions as a minister?
I'm very proud of
that. Parish Pumpery?
I think I'm very proud of that. The story of that is as you tell it. If you want to call it Parish Pumpery, that's all right. But before the election, I, like every single politician in that constituency, said that I would do everything I possibly could to get that station reopened. And so did everybody else, bar maybe two, Anna Shatter and somebody else who'd actually closed it at the time. And I said, I'll try and get that opened. And I will try and, as part of that, get other stations which have been wrongly opened as well. And if I had gone into government and said, oh, don't worry, that was last week, I would have been massacred for making promises which I had no intention of fulfilling. And so I went into government. I said, I want the Garda stations open, including Stepaside, but I will be quite happy for the guards to look at this and to decide the ones themselves. And that's what happened. The guards actually decided which ones, and they recommended six, all of which have been opened since. And I'm very proud of the fact that happened, because it was wrong nationally as well.
And the photo shoot of the opening happened too late for you.
The photo shoot, but I was there. The photo shoot was after the election. I mean, Stepaside, it happened about a month after the election. Yes, that's right. I mean,
yeah, you also, one of the other kind of Parish Pump controversies you were involved in was the Wesley College got 150,000 for their hockey pitch.
Yeah.
And you tweeted, but you reckon that actually lost you votes?
Oh, without a doubt at all. Without a doubt it did. Wesley College was where there was a grant given of 150,000 to a private school in my constituency, right? And which was a process which I had absolutely nothing to do with. But it was the sports grants. And obviously people get hold of it and the opposition say, you know, private school, minister's constituency, 2 and 2 makes 5. That's it. I did not.
But you tweeted out about it saying pleased you were. Yeah,
yeah, I did, and so did all the other. So did everybody else in the constituency as well. And I was delighted that they got it. But I mean, yeah, it was seized on, and that was the end of that. But to suggest that it was interfered with by me, that's not true.
Yeah,
yeah.
Listen,
go on.
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
No, but it was actually refused the first time around. It went to appeal. Yeah.
Okay. You paint an interesting picture of. The blue shirts that you were in bed with, you talk about them as being kind of privileged, like privately educated guys, a lot of them, and with a feeling of a kind of a divine right to rule. And I suppose what some people find funny is that you kind of present yourself as the radical in the room, but then people say, well, look, this is, you went to English public school, stockbroker, you know, capitalist insider and everything.
Yeah.
But was that your sense of them, yeah?
Yeah, I mean... The charges against me is kind of true, but I'd spent my life kind of challenging that type of consensus. Just because I had that sort of background doesn't mean I can't express opinions which don't necessarily reflect to benefit those people. Yeah, it was a very interesting analysis I did of the people in there. When I went in with Finian McGrath for the first meeting, I remember saying to him, "Have a look around you at the cabinet. This is the most conservative government in the history of the state." And you look around, you find that you had around you, and this is meant in a pejorative sense, you had a very, very conservative group of people, all Fine Gael, who were part of a tribe, who a large number of whom had fathers who'd been TDs or ministers as well. And they all thought the same way. They worked as a tribe, they worked together. They were very, very united in that sort of a way. And they weren't voices for change at all. And I went around them one by one. They were voices for keeping things the way they were as much as possible.
But not friends at all, you say?
No, not really.
Tribal, but not friends with each other.
No, not friends. Not friends at all. I've mentioned that to several senior ministers, including the Taoiseach, before
before leaving. In fact, I think just the day I left, I said to him, you know, it's been interesting, but do you have any friends amongst this lot here? And he said, yeah, that's been interesting. I tend to, and so did others. I tend to keep my friendships away from there. Or maybe you don't. They're not real friendships you have in there because you need each other for various things. But yeah. they were deeply conservative. And I just say, and I found that, if I could just say that, I'm on the judicial thing. That was really interesting because they were deeply against it, instinctively against it, against change in the appointments at all. They tried to get it through, some of them, because they promised to. But they were deeply against it because they were wedded to the kind of the establishment.
Yeah.
And they're a really establishment party.
Okay. And look, that's a whole other discussion for another day. Listen, just before you go, you say in the book, the sight of a TD or a senator arriving home after losing his or her seat must put the fear of God into their spouses.
Yeah.
And you say, you know, people go off to spend more time with the family, but did anyone ask the family? how are you getting on in retirement, political retirement?
Well, you never say never in situations like that, but I'm getting on fine because we got 4 months of government, so it was like continuity actually after the general election. We were working very, very hard, and then after that, I started on the book. I'd taken notes, of course, and I was ready to do it, but I wrote the book for 3 months, so that has actually occupied me. So I've been very, very busy doing all this sort of kind of frantic stuff, and will be for another few weeks.
Okay.
After that's going to be the telling period for me.
At least the whole country won't be locked down when you have to suddenly sit and face yourself anyway.
No, I'm not, that's right. I mean, the country's had a much rougher time.
You did never say never. You could be back into politics.
Well, I don't want to do nothing. I'm not going to do nothing. I mean, that's for certain. And you know, I'm a kind of political animal, and I like writing about politics and things like that. So I want to continue in that sort of milieu, certainly, where my strengths are. That won't be great news to everybody, but I'd hope to be able to do that.
A lot of people texting in, giving out about what you did to rural Ireland, etc.
Yeah.
Just one quick question. Give me a brief answer on this.
Yeah.
Would you have closed the golf clubs if you were still Minister for Sport this week?
I don't think I would have done, quite honestly.
Okay.
I think it would be, you know, that they are pretty well, you know, that it's the least offensive of sports.
Okay, Shane Ross, thanks a million. The book is called In Bed with the Blue Shirts, and it's published by Atlantic Books. Thank you, Shane. Take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.